Welcome to Long Now, a podcast exploring the many threads of long-term thinking. I'm Andrew Warner, your host for this episode. Today's episode was recorded on Black Point, the area of San Francisco now called Fort Mason, which is part of the unceded territories of the Ramaytush Ohlone. For thousands of years, the Ramaytush Ohlone were a crucial part of managing and stewarding the ecosystem of the Bay Area, using technologies such as controlled burns to shape a landscape that 18th and 19th century colonial settlers incorrectly believe was pristine, natural, and untouched by human hands. In the decades and centuries that followed, these settlers used war, slavery, illegal contracts, and dehumanizing ideologies to swiftly and systematically dispossess the Ramaytush Ohlone people of their land, almost completely wiping them out in the process. But the story of the Ramaytush Ohlone is not only one of our past, as is often assumed, but one of our future, too. And if we want to foster long-term thinking about our place on this corner of the planet, we ought to get good at listening to what the land needs. And the experts with millennia of experience should be leading these conversations. The Ramaytush Ohlone people continue to inhabit San Francisco and have taken a leading role in how we think about our long-term ecological and social futures. Our podcast guest today is Dr. Jonathan Cordero, the executive director of the Association of Ramaytush Ohlone. Dr. Cordero is a cultural sociologist, indigenous scholar, and community leader, whose work explores the history of indigenous sovereignty and identity. In this talk, he focuses on indigenous sovereign futures, what they mean, and how these visions of the future can shape our present. Before we hear from Jonathan, a quick note. All of the Long Now Foundation support comes from our donors and members. If you're already a member, thank you. You make all of this possible. If you haven't yet joined, please consider going to longnow.org/join and become the newest member of Long Now. It only takes a few minutes to set up, and after that, you'll be connected to a whole world of long-term thinking. And now, Dr. Jonathan Cordero on Indigenous Sovereign Futures.
Well, Hersha Tuhi, thank you all for being here. We have the good fortune of having our culture director in the house tonight, who usually opens up events like this. So Greg Castro, will you come up and do the honors, please?
Hersha Tuhi, I thought I had the night off. Thought I'd sit in the back and just heckle them. No, I'm honored to be here. This area of San Francisco Peninsula, we used to call Yalamo in the aforetime. And within that, there were multiple communities that lived in existence with each other, in relationship to each other, and relationship to the land for at least 10,000 years, if not more. It's been a little rough the last 250 years, but we're still around, we're still here, and we still remember our obligation given to us by Creator, as we were taught, to take care of the land and take care of the living things on it, and now include you. I'm sure my ancestors would be a little puzzled by your wardrobe and some of the other things like cell phones, but you're still living beings, so we take care of you as well. So I usually have some instruments to play a song, but we're gonna skip that tonight. Thank you for the opportunity to be here and to have an open heart and listen. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Thanks, everyone, for being here. I'm just to let you all know, I was diagnosed with lymphoma last year, and I just went through chemo. This is my first public presentation in over a year. Thank you. So be nice. I'm happy to be here and talk about the topic, the title, which is Indigenous Sovereign Futures. We'll talk a little bit about what that means. But I want to start with the place where I want to begin this conversation, which is really just a statement. And you can disagree or not with this or agree with it. But this is what I've written just briefly. Alternative visions for social change rooted in the frameworks of capitalism, colonialism, and heteropatriarchy only reproduce contemporary power structures. So the question tonight is, how do we continue toward structural transformation? So a little bit about me before we go there. I have a PhD in sociology. I was teaching in the academy for a while, and then I started our nonprofit a couple of years ago, but I still have a visiting scholar position at USC. The murder of George Floyd was horrible, but it was really nice during the period of time that followed that we finally started talking about systemic discrimination. Systemic is one of those sociological words that we've used for a very long time. It was nice that it finally made it out into the public. Well, structural transformation is another one of those phrases that we use in the social sciences, especially in sociology, to talk about what it is that we need to do to really change the world that we live in. And that's going to require structural transformation. So let me do a little framing. This book called Epistemologies of the South is about how to begin thinking about solving the problems of capitalism and colonialism and heteropatriarchy in our contemporary society. And Dr. Santos does a really good job of just giving us a framework for thinking about that. And what he does in the book is he juxtaposes the epistemologies of the North, the global North. And by global North, he's referring to Canada, United States, Europe, et cetera. It's not a fixed geographic location, by the way. The global North can be in the South, the geographic South. And then epistemologies of the South. And epistemologies of the South includes, for example, groups like indigenous peoples and their way of being in the world. And epistemologies of the North, global North, have dominated the world for a long time. And we keep, again, thinking about alternatives to the problems that we've created in the global North using, guess what, the epistemologies of the global North. And we can't think our way out of the problems. So one of his propositions then is to look for solutions to the problems in the world that we live in by searching through the epistemologies of what he calls the anti-imperialist South. So that would be, for example, that would include indigenous knowledge, right? Indigenous cultures. In order to get there, we need to talk about indigeneity and sovereignty first, so that you understand what it means to be indigenous in the world that we live in. So indigeneity is a big, broad concept. It includes a lot of things. And today we're just gonna be using it to talk about ancestry. So in other words, what does it mean for someone to be indigenous? And the answer is, it means that you're a descendant of the original people of the place. Technically speaking, indigeneity or indigenousness is periodized, so prior to colonization, right? So there's a temporal definition, there's a spatial definition, but indigeneity and indigenousness are really relational. In other words, we're indigenous and you're not. And that's important, obviously, for us as we think about our place in the world. In our culture, you have to prove that you have, in this case, California Indian ancestry. You don't get to just walk in a room and say that you have it. So we don't abide by the standard of self-identification that is used in non-native cultures. That doesn't work for us for a lot of reasons. The indigenous worldview is going to be a really important part of our conversation today. And there's lots of different ways to think about what an indigenous worldview is and how it differs from a non-indigenous worldview. And by the way, indigenous peoples are not the only ones who hold this kind of worldview. That's also very important. But when we think about an indigenous worldview, it has these basic components. And I'm going to use the phrase native lifeways to get at that. Native lifeways are based on the deep respect and accompanying humility. It's a key virtue in native cultures, derived from various understandings that we are all interconnected and interdependent, that we should live in a web of connectedness absent of authoritarian power, that our Earth Mother does not provide resources for extraction, but gifts for thriving, and that one of our primary responsibilities as Native peoples is to maintain balance and harmony in nature. And one of the ways my colleague Greg Kastner and I try to communicate this is by talking about our relationship to Mother Earth by using a different preposition. So lots of, for example, we work with lots of ecological restoration organizations. Most of the time they talk about what they're going to do to the land. And we talk about what we're going to do with the land. And that simple difference in prepositions makes a radical difference, right, in orientation to the world. Let's talk a little bit about sovereignty. In order to exercise authority within a particular tribal territory, you have to be indigenous to that land. And so this is one of the differences that we indigenous peoples have with other groups, other racial and ethnic groups. So the question is, what differentiates us from other racial and ethnic groups in the United States? And the answer is, we're sovereign and they're not. When the federal government grants federal recognition to an American Indian tribe, what is it that the federal government is recognizing? And they're recognizing our, what we call indigenous sovereignty. When you get federal recognition, we call that tribal sovereignty. But it's recognizing our indigenous sovereignty. That's our original sovereignty. That's our inherent sovereignty that we have as the original peoples of this place. It pre-exists and is independent of the federal government's recognition. And all tribal peoples have it, whether they're federally recognized or not. So we are sovereign in this land as Native peoples. And so oftentimes that idea, which is an exclusive idea, right? This is about exclusivity, it's us and not others, runs afoul of the politics of inclusivity. Sovereignty is also, so sovereignty is based on that. It's about really for us, we're just gonna talk about it in two contexts. One is self-governance. And self-governance, the way I think Western Europeans think about it, is really radically different from the way that Native peoples think about governance. The other is the idea of cultural continuance. And cultural continuance is incredibly important because what differentiates us from other American Indian groups is our culture. We're effectively, if you ask the scientists, we're effectively the same racial group of people. But what differentiates us one from another is our culture, our language. So in order for us to retain our distinctiveness as a social group, we have to maintain the integrity of our culture moving forward into the future. So one of the questions you'll likely have at the end is, hey, you know, if Native peoples got it going on and you have some of the answers that we need, can you share your knowledge, your traditional ecological knowledge or your cultural knowledge with us to help us think ourselves out of the problem that we've created? But the problem with non-Native peoples and capitalism and colonialism is that you're always taking from Native peoples. And so my response to you is go get your own. And you don't need to continue taking from Native peoples, because we have to ask all the questions. Who's doing the taking? What are they gonna do with it? Is it gonna be systemic change, or is this just for you and your little project, right? So you'll get, I'm a little bit facetious about things, so you'll hear me say that. Sovereignty is critical for us, right? In order to act as a sovereign entity, right? The tribe has to be descended of the original peoples, and they can only exercise authority within their tribal territory. And so, for example, we do lots of projects with, again, ecological restoration organizations, and oftentimes they want to invite all the Native groups to the table to do work in our territory. That's a violation of our sovereignty. And we're having discussions now at the state level about the state violating our sovereignty under the good intentions of being inclusive. It's becoming a problem for us. So again, the sort of progressive political standard of self-identification, the progressive politics of inclusivity are problematic for us in some instances, right? Doesn't always work for us. Well, let me get to it now. Let me talk a little bit about decolonization. So the fundamental writings on decolonization basically argue, hey, colonization was defined by the removal of native peoples from their land and their, you know, forced labor or enslavement. In California, that's exactly what happened. Our ancestors were forcibly removed from their land in a colonial system, and they were enslaved at the California missions. They weren't forced to work, they were enslaved. Slavery is not defined by ownership of persons, which is a very American definition. And so that defines colonialism. So decolonization should be the opposite. The world has changed radically because of colonialism and capitalism. And if you gave us land back today, we would not really be able to reproduce the kind of way of life that we had prior to colonization, because the landscape has been changed so radically. But losing our land, and try not to conceive of land as property, try to think of land as, in this case, if you're native, it's your mother, right? The land is our earth mother. It's a relative of ours that we're responsible for caring for. And she cares for us in the same way. We didn't just lose our land. Native worldviews, native culture is defined specifically by our direct relationship with our ancestral homeland. Our culture, our spirituality, our identity is based on having that direct connection with the land. And if the land is taken away from us, then we lose to some degree our wholeness as a people. And so we didn't just lose our land, right? We lost that connection to our earth mother that defines us as people. And more specifically, we lost, in California especially, and with the missionized groups from Soma and San Diego, we lost our culture. We lost, more specifically, our epistemologies, right? Our way of thinking about ourselves in the world. And that's what we call epistemicide. So genocide and epistemicide go hand in hand. The loss, the truncation of that relationship to land means also the loss of the epistemology, the worldview that goes with it. And so we've been in the process, California Indians have been in the process of trying to rebuild and recreate that. You hear words like cultural revitalization. A lot of groups are doing that. And it's helpful, but it's not actually what we need. So here's the problem with decolonization. Decolonization is essentially about shedding colonialism. In a sense, it's getting rid of colonialism. And my question to the folks who espouse decolonization as a practice is, if you're shedding colonialism, what is it that you're putting in its place? That's an important question. Not just for non-natives, but for native peoples too, right? And so we come to that problem, which is non-native peoples want to decolonize. They think that American Indians have an epistemology and a worldview that can help them, and traditional ecological knowledge that can help them get out of the situation that they're in. So they come knocking at our door and they say, can you help us? And my response is, we can give you our knowledge, but that's not what you need. So this is an abstract example, so don't worry about the details. But a scientific community approached an American Indian group and said, hey, we want to learn about traditional ecological practices. Will you share your knowledge with us? And the tribal community said, sure. And they shared it with the scientific group, and the scientific group went back, they implemented that knowledge, it didn't work. They came back to the tribal community and said, hey, we did what you told us to, it didn't work. And the tribal community said, well, you didn't take our songs and stories with you. Within those songs and stories and ceremonies is embedded an indigenous worldview, right? In which all things are equal, in which all beings right, are interdependent, interconnected, and there's no hierarchy. There's a different kind of power. And that's what you need. You don't need our knowledge. You need a radical shift in worldview where you begin to think about yourself and your place in the world as part of an integrated whole. And that elements of nature, beings in nature, are your relatives, right? And that position of deep respect generates a humility that will allow for that kind of change. The question is, where are you going to get it, right? Where are you going to get it? Where are you going to find it? So let me read to you, if you don't mind. I brought some books. And I like the way I say things, but sometimes other people just do a better job. So I want to start by reading from Taiyaki Alfred, who wrote a book, probably one of the best books that I've ever read as a Native person, called Peace, Power, and Righteousness. And he's going to talk here about Native epistemology, and I want to read to you his words. The value of the indigenous critique of the Western world view lies not in the creation of false dichotomies, but in the insight that the colonial attitudes and structures imposed on the world by Europeans are not manifestations of an inherent evil. In other words, European peoples are not inherently evil. You can go like this. He says, they are mere reflections of white society's understanding of its own power and relationship with nature, right? It's the worldview that treats, you know, things in nature as resources for extraction, not gifts for thriving, right? He says, the brutal regime of European technological advancement, intent on domination, confronted its opposite in indigenous societies. The resulting near extinction of indigenous peoples created a vacuum in which the European regime established its political, economic, and philosophical dominance. So again, the idea is it's not our knowledge that is important for social change. It's thinking about differences in worldview. That's what is really necessary here. There's a couple passages, if you don't mind, on freedom and justice that I'd like to read to you as well. And the first comes from Leanne Simpson, who wrote a book. And again, that's an amazing book. It's called As We Have Always Done. Get it? We've always been this way. We've always done it this way. It's worked for thousands and thousands of years, as we have always done. She coins a term called radical resurgence. Lots of people are coining terms for the way that we should begin thinking about the world. And she says this, resurgence is hope for me because of its simultaneous dismantling of settler colonial meta-manifestations and its reinvigoration of indigenous systemic alternatives. Alternatives that have already produced sustainable, beautiful, principled societies. Yet, we need more visioning, thinking, acting, and mobilization around these indigenous systemic alternatives, because creating the alternative is the mechanism through which freedom, the way that Native peoples define it, can be achieved. Engagement with indigenous systems changes indigenous peoples. It is a highly emergent and generative process. This requires less engagement with the state and more presence within indigenous realities. This requires struggle and commitment. So I think the point she's making here is really for us, Native peoples, which is we should probably spend a little less time trying to get federal recognition and more time trying to get our traditional culture back in order so that we can have that worldview, right? And the culture and the spirituality that we need to move into the future in a way that is more conducive to living well. I'm curious what you all are gonna do, but I think she at least has an idea what we're all gonna do. And then I want to read this to you as just a way of ending, because it's a very strong wording, and I think it's helpful for you to understand that Indigenous peoples don't always align themselves with the politics, even progressive politics, of the world that we live in. It's this radical worldview and way of thinking and being in the world that is really different for us. She says, Indigenous peoples require a land base and therefore require a central and hard critique of the forces that propel dispossession. I am not interested in multicultural resurgence or an artistic resurgence as a mechanism for inclusion into the Canadian mosaic. She lives in Canada. I am not interested in a resurgence that continues to replicate anti-queerness and heteropatriarchy. I am not interested in a resurgence that replicates anti-blackness. I am not interested in inclusion. I am not interested in reconciling. I am interested in unapologetic, place-based nationhoods using Indigenous practices and operating in an ethical and principled way from an intact land base. This is the base from which we can begin to develop a new relationship with the Canadian state. In other words, she's saying to Native peoples, you need to get your act together as you think about moving into the future and have a different kind of relationship with the state than the one that just, as we started from the beginning, than the one that just reproduces the existing hierarchy, right? These existing power structures. I think that's it for me. How do we do on time? Perfect? Okay, we'll give it time.
Thank you so much. That was lovely. So can you tell us more about the critical mission studies project? I grew up with a sort of a very sanitized version of it, and I'm curious to hear how that's going from academic and an academic book and flowing through to the education system.
Sure. So it's actually quite remarkable that the University of California, this grant came from the University of California Regents, gave $1 million for a research project in the humanities. That might not sound startling to you, but it's quite startling for the UC to do that, actually. And so there were 4 non-Native PIs and 4 California Indian PIs on the project. And we basically had $1 million to spend to basically revise the scholarship on the mission period in California from the perspective of Native peoples and our allies. Now, that doesn't mean that scholarship hadn't been written before. I had written plenty of scholarship on the California missions well before this, and other scholars had too. But this is the first volume that was really funded, and it's really long, and it's really an amazing work. And so we've got a target date probably of about 2025 for this to come out. And you'll have articles in the volume that, you know, are written by California Indian scholars and communities that really take a good, hard, critical look at the conventional scholarship, that sort of resist the conventional scholarship, but also then, include our own perspectives and information. And I just have to say, as a social scientist, and our scholarship is just better. It just is. There's 2 introductions. I wrote one, and in that introduction, I kind of indict some of the scholarship from some of the folks. Like I was saying earlier, this idea that slavery is defined by ownership of persons, therefore slavery didn't happen at the California missions. Really? Right? That's a very convenient definition of slavery to use to deny that the Franciscan missionaries were responsible for enslaving Native peoples. So if you use Orlando Patterson's definition, it's much more accurate, and it's based on a global understanding of slavery, not on a very narrow American definition of slavery. So we do things like that.
Awesome. Zooming back out for a moment, a lot of what you talked about tonight seemed to be about place-based knowledge and knowledge and culture tied to the land. And, you know, taking a long now look at the next few hundred years, there's probably going to be a lot of global migration as certain land becomes either really hard or functionally impossible to support humans on. And where do you see the place? Like, how do we carry that land based wisdom? Like, is it possible to carry that wisdom with us as if we are forced to sort of change locations?
Yeah, this is a good question for all of us. Honestly, I would love to hear what you have to say. I was talking to a group of K-12 teachers in San Mateo County the day I was doing a workshop on indigeneity. And, you know, I said to them what I basically have been saying to you, which is that, you know, indigenous peoples, we have this worldview, this way of, you know, being in the world that is really conducive to a better future. And, you know, and the teachers had a really hard time not being able to think out of the idea that the only place to go and get that knowledge is indigenous peoples. But there are so many other groups out there that share similar kinds of perspectives. We are not the only ones. And like I said before, you all have indigenous histories, right? And groups that may still have some of this information intact, who knows? But the scientific community does. And there are other even American Indian groups who are willing to share this kind of information. But the problem is, again, it's not that the knowledge doesn't exist. It's not that the worldview doesn't exist out there. It's able to be had. It's whether or not the change is systemic. Because we can help various ecological organizations do their work differently and maybe in a better way. But how do we think about long-term change in that regard? So this gets us to something I know we were going to talk about later on, but we'll talk about it now. You know, the question that Greg and I ask ourselves is, how does knowledge like the knowledge I've shared with you tonight, how does it shape or influence the work that we do in our nonprofit? And it's really a twofold answer. The first is, we have to do something. And so we partner with ecological restoration organizations to try to restore balance and harmony back into watersheds as much as that is possible. We know there are severe constraints, but as much as that is possible. So we do what we can with the resources that we have. And that was my question for my son. He came to me one day and said, you know, Dad, this capitalism is enormous. Colonialism is embedded. You know, I feel like there's nothing we can do to really make a difference. But if you're out there in the world, you'll notice that there are groups, not just indigenous groups, who are out there doing agriculture differently, right? Doing farming differently, doing restoration differently. And the sum total of all those small groups is going to make a difference. It has made a difference. So, you know, my answer to him was, we can do what we have with the resources that we have. That said, we have to continue having conversations like this. In other words, we have to continue to push the envelope and say, the alternatives that, you know, that we keep creating within these capitalist, colonial, heteropatriarchal frameworks, they don't serve us. They don't change things. They just reproduce what already exists. And so we need to continue to have those conversations. And so, again, you know, my resistance to people who want to come in and take our knowledge is multifold, but it's basically, that's not what you need. You don't need our knowledge. You need a shift in a worldview. That's what you need. And I can't help you with that. You know, Greg and I were at a panel a couple of years ago, and we were listening to an audience member ask the panel questions about how to fix things as if it was our responsibility. We didn't create this problem. You know, you all fix it. You know, we're going to do our best to move toward our sovereignty, which includes maintaining the integrity of our culture and our community, right? And our systems of government, our notions of freedom and our notions of justice. Our notion of justice is to restore harmony. That's what justice looks like for us, right? it's not equality under the law, in a sense. It's to restore harmony, because in our worldview and in our culture, everyone is equally valuable, right? We don't have these kinds of hierarchies, and at least in the ideal, right? And so for us, as we move towards sovereignty, we will naturally decolonize. We don't need to sort of imbibe in the literature on decolonization and the idea of decolonization. If we do this move towards sovereignty, that is naturally going to happen for us. So we don't need to be concerned with decolonization per se, right? So I think that's interesting. That's a really long answer to your question.
No, that's great. So much knowledge is embedded in language, and I'm curious where your organization, the Ramba Toshaloni, is in terms of the role of language and linguistic preservation in sort of gaining knowledge back.
Yeah, so here's our secret. It's not really a secret, everybody knows. We suffered severe losses as a result of colonization. There were about, 1,500 to 2,000 Ramba Toshaloni persons on the San Francisco Peninsula. And when colonization was all said and done, by roughly about, I can give you almost the exact date, by around 1920, there was only one family that had living descendants in the present, and that's our family. In other words, of all of the people on the entire San Francisco Peninsula, only one family survived. That means we lost our community, that means we lost our culture, and we lost our language. Fortunately for Greg and I, because this is your question, well, how are you native? I have a Chumash background, and the Chumash culture, by the way, probably has the most information that's been saved through the course of history by various academics and scholars and others. So we have our Chumash culture, and then Greg is both Salin and Rumsen, so he has those. So we bring those traditions to bear on the work that we do. How many of you have seen the movie Whale Rider? Good for you. Great. It's just like the first time I've asked that question. People have actually seen it. Whale Rider is about how traditions change, right? The historical circumstances dictate change in culture. And so cultures and traditions aren't static. They're constantly changing. And so we need to move toward a traditional culture. It doesn't have to be the same one in the past. And that, that we can use then to address these contemporary political and economic and philosophical concerns that we have. And so that's really our task, is to try to reconstruct, like every other tribe in California, to in some measure, not all, but most, we're trying to recreate ourselves in the present, after severe losses, right? That's why genocide and epistemicide and removal from land are really, they're really serious. They have a just enormous, disastrous impact on Native peoples. The very first, just to let you have something that'll be coming, the very first line in my chapter in the book is that California Indians have always been in the way of someone else's so-called progress. That's what it means to be Native in California.
I think of a question over here.
Hi. I've been thinking about the Native American church on and off, and I was curious for your feelings about how it fits into the situation here, maybe around its ability to encourage changes in worldview. And also my pretty uneducated sense is that the Native American church is across indigenous groups. And I was hearing from you that there's an emphasis on sovereignty of single groups standing up for their own sovereignty. I'm curious how you see that interplaying.
Yeah, can I ask, is the Native American church, is it Native American in its spirituality, or is it Christian in its religion?
So I'm more familiar in the one that has not an explicit Christian influence. I know there are both lineages that have a Christian through line and those that don't.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't have a ton to say about it because I really don't know what the nature of the organization is. But I'll say this much, you know, I'm reading a scholar from the Midwest. We're reading a, you know, an indigenous scholar from the Midwest. We're reading an indigenous scholar from Canada, and I'm an indigenous scholar in California. We share a lot in common. There are just some, you know, very similar ways in living and worldview and relationships to nature that are really common across indigenous groups. That doesn't mean we're all the same, right? And so if a group chooses to get together to share indigenous spirituality, I imagine that would be very interesting for them to do, and a choice that they make. But I don't think it would interfere with tribal governance, which is the sort of fundamental basis of sovereignty, at least in the context in which we're talking about it. So I would be all for that. And it's really their decision how it impacts, you know, their tribe. But the tribe is a collective. It's not, you know, one or two or three people who go to this church and then, you know, who bring it back. Native spirituality is really important to us. And it's something that we actually don't share a lot with the public. We were asked a lot of times to share our stories. And when we're very selective about what stories we do share. Most of our stories are, again, embedded in our worldview and our cosmology and our spirituality. And if we shared a story with you, it would be like telling the story of the birth of Jesus without its religious significance. It would just be a story. But the stories that in Chumash culture, the stories are just deeply rich. They're morally instructive. They invoke the Chumash cosmology and spiritual practices and ideas embedded in culture and language that are really beyond us. We today, it's a very difficult for us to imagine what the world was like for our ancestors and what these stories actually meant to them. We can get a little bit of a taste, but they're just deeply meaningful, and we can only scratch the surface, right? So to share those with you would just be why. It's just a story. And to us, stories are, again, deeply meaningful, deeply spiritual. And we should really hold on to those, because if we share those with non-native peoples and then they go out and share those, then we begin to lose the integrity of our culture, right? So we're very cautious about sharing stories and dances. Another way of thinking about this is I do a lot of work in the arts, and we're often asked to serve on panels to talk about native art. Well, most of our dances, songs, stories, and regalia, most of those things are ceremonial. They're both cultural and they're secular and sacred, right? They're cultural and spiritual. There's no separating them out. So to talk about ceremonial regalia as if it was an art is a very Western European way of thinking about things, and it objectifies our culture as opposed to treating our culture as this integrated whole, which it is, that is deeply embedded, again, in our, you know, our systems, our cultural systems and spiritual systems. So we can't really do that. We can't really talk about it as art. It really really sort of undermines the sort of deep meaning that's a part of our culture. So it's hard to do that. I don't encourage members of our community to treat our ceremony as art, because it's not. It's not art.
Got one over here.
Thank you so much for all your shares this evening. I am struck by the topic around land return and reuniting with land. And I work with a lot of tribes to return land, and we experiencing a lot of complexities with the system, of course, because we're trying to work with the systems of today to transform the systems for the future. And I'm curious about your perspective on non-federally recognized tribes who very clearly don't want to participate in these systems. Yet when we are doing land returns, sometimes we have to create an entity, a nonprofit, or something like that. And we're in this moment of transition. And I'd love to hear more thoughts around where these systems meet the ancient worldviews and the worldviews that are to come, that are yet to be created. Mm-hmm. If you have any more thoughts to share.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Thank you. This is a problem. And I'll start by saying this. When in the first year, the first half year of when we started our nonprofit, Peninsula Open Space Trust offered us 38 acres, and we said no, because we did not have the financial, human, and economic resources to manage that land over time. In other words, especially non-recognized tribes lack capacity. And we're actually seeing, a change in the grant world now where grantors are giving grants that are not tied to implementation only. They're general support grants because they recognize that we lack capacity. So, for example, the San Francisco Estuary Blueprint is basically an ecological restoration of the land from the Golden Gate Bridge all the way to the foothills of the Sierras. That's an immense, right? Place. And there's lots of technological information and scientific information that's coming to us as a partner in this process that we don't have the expertise to understand, right? And our traditional ecological knowledge isn't sufficient to tell us how to manage, for example, sea level rise. It's not there, right? So we need to scientific expertise to inform us, and then we can make a decision about how to move forward. So we would need funding to hire a scientist who could translate for us and then help us determine the best course of action, right? So it's very similar with land back. If you give land back to tribes that don't have capacity or who don't want to participate in the capitalist colonial system, right? That's problematic on both counts, right? They lack capacity, so you have to wait for them to get it if they want to, and others just say, just give us our land back. We don't want, you know, et cetera. So the state is actually trying to give land back to tribes right now. I was talking to someone who works for the state who's trying to do this. And the state keeps coming up with excuses why they can't do it. And the tribe is just sitting there going, what's your problem? You said you'd do it. We're here. We've got our, you know, I's dotted and T's crossed. What's the problem? And the answer is because the state doesn't want to do it, right? So there's lots of obstacles to giving land back. And it's really up to the individual tribe to make decision to do that, and then how to do that, when to do it. But the obstacles that we confront in order to make that happen are tremendous. If we wanted to get land back from the city of San Francisco, for example, it would literally have to go on the ballot and the community would have to approve of the land transfer. But right now, the city is not equipped to literally give public land back to Native organizations. So our lawyers, and we have plenty, would have to work with the city's lawyers to remake the law in order to make that land transfer possible from the city of San Francisco. What we keep hearing, though, is that it's impossible, which is not true. Everything is possible, and get your lawyers together and our lawyers together and you all can figure it out, right? It is not impossible. So it's just a matter really of will. So there's a lot of complexity in your question. I'm probably not doing a very good job of addressing it, but it is challenging across the board for especially unrecognized tribes to figure out how to do that in a way that is really conducive to their worldview, their understanding of land as property. I mean, literally, it's antithetical to Native peoples, right? It's an anathema to us to own land. Land is our mother. We don't own our mother, right? But we would have to be willing to own land in order to get land and live on it and develop it and do whatever we want with it, right?
That's a really good segue to, I think, a good ending question. So the Association of Ramaytush Ohlone is a nonprofit. What's some of the work that you're excited about right now in terms of at the nonprofit level and sort of working in the city? And also, how can people get involved or, you know, find out more?
I'll answer the last question first. So this is just the beginning of our third full year as a nonprofit. And so our projects are not in the implementation stage, so there's not really a lot of opportunity. If somebody's looking for a job, we need an administrative assistant very badly. And we pay pretty well, actually. So just let you know. What are we excited about? The short answer is, as Native peoples, we have this dual responsibility to care for Mother Earth and to care for the people who reside in our ancestral homeland, especially marginalized populations. And so any project at the intersection of what we just generically call ecology and equity, right? Caring for the earth, caring for people. Any project at the intersection of those two is an important project for us. So we are working with the Friendship House and the Cultural Conservancy to put an Indigenous garden in the lower southwest corner of Golden Gate Park by the windmill. And that garden space will provide opportunities for clients of the Friendship House who are American Indians in recovery to finally get out into nature, which is healing for them. There'll be a gathering space for ceremony, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one of the projects at the intersection of ecology and equity. We've been working with the city of San Francisco to raise $12 million, which we did, to plant trees in the Tenderloin and South Market. And two things here. One is marginalized groups have less greenery in their communities than other groups. And exposure to greenery, that means open space and trees and parks and gardens and things like that. They have a positive influence on our physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual health. So it's, in a sense, it's a public health concern that marginalized communities don't have that. So we're doing that. We're putting in two huge grants with Safer Bay in the down on the peninsula in East Palo Alto, another marginalized community, and another grant in San Bruno and Millbrae along the coast, another marginalized community, to help manage flooding and sea level rise. Some artist or some activist went and marked 2 feet of sea level rise in the community of San Bruno with like blue tape. Not good for realtors. And it is actually really incredible to think that in maybe 100 years or less, that is all going to be underwater. And all of those impoverished, you know, relatively, comparatively impoverished folks will have to find somewhere else to live. Right. So it's a major concern. So anything at the intersection of ecology and equity is a huge concern for us. We're also doing a really exciting, I hope, we're trying to get approval to do a really exciting art project, but I'll wait and share that with you when we get the money.
All right. Well, thank you so much. It's been a lovely evening.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
In the week since this talk, I found myself thinking a lot about the ideas that Jonathan shared. Specifically, I've been thinking about the challenges raised by the last audience member. How do we simultaneously interrogate a flawed system and poke at its intellectual foundations, while also acknowledging that we must somehow engage with that system to make meaningful progress in the short term? This is an issue that everyone who wants to make the world a better place wrestles with, and there doesn't seem to be an easy way out. I also found myself thinking about Jonathan's idea of working in opposition to something, first building something new that is not inherently defined by what it opposes. In this case, it was decolonialism versus building a sovereign indigenous culture. But I think the general lesson of focusing on what one wants to build and nurture, rather than building your movement or ideology against another system, is so beautiful. It's a helpful reframing for so many movements that get caught up in the logic of the system they wish to fight. If this talk resonated with you, please consider sharing it with your friends. We rely almost exclusively on word of mouth to grow our audience, and so anytime you rate or share the podcast or tell a friend about an episode you've been thinking about, it helps us nurture this long-term thinking community. To learn more about Jonathan's work, visit the Association for Ramatish Ohlone website. If you want to watch the full video of Jonathan's talk and get a peek into what sovereign Indigenous futures might look like, go to longnow.org. While you're there, you can learn more about our other projects and also become a Long Now member. As always, we'd like to thank our speakers, our listeners, our sponsors, and our members. This work wouldn't be possible without you. Today's music comes from Jason Wool, as well as Brian Eno's January 07003, Bell Studies for the Clock of the Long Now. As always, thank you to our production team, Daniel Engelman, Justin Oliphant, Jacob Cooperman, Shannon Breen, Casey Kripe, and the entire Long Now staff who make each of these conversations possible. We look forward to next time.